Welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Globus, your host for the channel. Today we're talking with Ian West about his new book, Technology in the Country House, which he co-authored with Marilyn Palmer. Ian, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Right, okay. Well, I was originally an engineer in the natural gas industry for 30 years until I got bored with it. So I became an archaeologist. I reinvented myself and went off to study archaeology, specializing in the archaeology of what Americans would call historical archaeology, the sort of particularly the industrial period. I went off and did a master's in that. And then I enjoyed it so much, I carried on and did a PhD, doctorate in archaeology, again looking at the sort of industrialization and textile mills in particular in the UK. Just to sort of bring my co-author in at this point, Marilyn was my PhD supervisor while I was doing my doctorate, and she was nearing retirement, and this was basically her sort of swan song, and she dragged me along to help her with the research and to help her with writing the book. So that's how Marilyn and I got together. She was my supervisor, and now she's my co-author.
What interested the two of you in this subject in particular? Because there's a lot written about country houses, but this idea of technology, which as presented in the book, is a really fascinating subject on a number of different levels. But what drew you to that aspect of that subject in particular?
Okay. Well, I at this point, I will speak briefly on Marilyn's behalf. She actually has a background. She grew up in the below stairs areas of country houses, because her parents were both in the last days of service in country house, but just after the war. Her father was a butler and her mother was a housekeeper. So she has she's had a lifelong interest in country houses, because that's where she grew up in them, if you like. Her and my speciality has been the archaeology of, particularly of industry. This is a sort of manifestation of industry in the country house, because country houses, in some cases in their estates, they had what we could regard as industrial enterprises and industrial types of equipment and systems and processes going on in the estates. What we're talking about are the sort of manifestations of things like energy production, for example, in a domestic setting. So that's our angle into the country house, because that's the sort of the industrialization, if you like, of the country house estate.
As an aspect of that, you early on in the book, you address this question about the dynamic between the introduction of technology and the role of servants in the household. And that brings us to, I think, what's a good entry point into the book, which is this issue of, broadly speaking, the role of technology in the country house compared to what had been the case prior to the introduction of all these technologies, starting at the end of the 18th century, going on into the 20th, which is the area of the focus of your book. How did country houses operate before all of these technologies were introduced, and how have we interpreted or misinterpreted perhaps that dynamic between the servants and the technology?
Well, I think we probably sort of perhaps look slightly further back, and the period sort of like the pre-industrial period, when there were nevertheless sort of what you could regard as changes in technology, which helped or perhaps were driven by the changes in the way people lived in country houses, but also facilitated those changes. For example, in their early days, country houses were castles. They were fortified manors, and the families and their servants, their retinue, lived really closely side by side, in one space in the medieval sort of fortified manor houses with big halls and so on. And then through the medieval period, you've got a greater desire for the the elite to have privacy. So they start living separately from their servants. And so you get houses with lots of rooms, and so lots of rooms need fireplaces and so on. So you get the evolution, if you like, of the house with its heating. And all of this creates extra work. The servants are no longer next to the family, and you get specialization in the way that the houses were designed, especially in separate areas for different tasks and so on. So it was a gradual evolution. What then happened, obviously, sort of the period we're looking at focusing on particularly is from the mid 18th century, where you've got in process of industrialization, new materials, new technologies and so on available, which accelerate this process, really. Perhaps one of the things that I think perhaps you're getting at is the degree to which these innovations are there, or how they impact upon the servants, I guess. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, that's part of it, but there's also this other aspect which you address in the book, which is the argument as to sort of whether did the technology was the technology introduced to replace departing servants,
yeah,
or was it in fact the technology introduced and the reliance upon servants became less?
That's what I was heading towards. Mm-hmm. I think it's been generally sort of misunderstood. There's been a misapprehension that people invested in new technology to enable them to have fewer servants, and there's no real evidence of that. Not certainly not through until the early 20th century, when you start seeing things coming through innovations which are deliberately aimed at reducing workload, reducing the servants, because at that stage servants were expensive and they were in short supply. But up to that point, up until the early 20th century, really the focus was on improving comfort first of all of the occupants, and improving their prestige in terms of the way they impressed their guests. So the country house moved from the medieval period, when it was still very much a sort of a fortified place that you sort of kept your neighbours out, to by the time you get to the 17th century, it's a place where you want your neighbours to come in and be impressed. And so you want the house to be comfortable, and you know, you want it to be opulent, you want it to be well lit and impressive in lots of ways, and you want it to function almost invisibly. So you want your servants beavering away in the background so that you can't see them. So the focus is not really on reducing servant numbers. In fact, some of the technologies like electric lighting, for example, which is very sort of readily embraced by country house owners, and a lot of tech pioneering work on electric lighting happened in country houses. That increased the numbers of people they wanted. It didn't reduce them. So it was very much about first of all comfort for the family and the image they presented to their guests.
Another aspect of that also comes across in your book is that, as you point out, not only did the technology not necessarily reduce the number of workers, but also that is this technology oftentimes required those servants to be far more knowledgeable, more technologically gifted, better trained, and in that sense was, you know, in some respects more of a challenge in terms of staffing than if they had simply stuck with the old ways of hauling chamber pots and lighting yes. candles.
yes, that's certainly true. But also in some cases, there was, if necessary, to bring specialists in, and you get that you got that with electric lighting, you got that with the motor car, you needed skilled people who didn't exist on the estate. Sometimes the estate workers were sent away to be trained, and sometimes you brought people in, and bringing people in to to the hitherto closed world of the country house estate often brought its problems, because these were people who had a very different background, who didn't necessarily have generations of history of subservience to their sort of feudal lord, and therefore had very different social attitudes. So that was often a cause of tension, and these people would come in with different from a different environment, really. But yes, in many ways, the servants were embracing new technology, not always willingly.
And this gets to another aspect of country houses that I must confess I didn't really fully appreciate until I read this book, which is the degree to which they had to be self-sufficient. And it's one of these very self-evident things that is so obvious once it's made clear, but it really doesn't come across as clearly as it does when you talk about this technology. I mean, nowadays we read about these comforts, electric lighting, sewage, and so forth, and we think about connecting to these grids. And yet when you talk about these country houses, especially in the 19th century, they're out in the middle of nowhere. They have to, in effect, create their own systems and infrastructure from scratch. And the challenge that poses in terms of expertise and expense.
Yes, that is an important factor and a very sort of distinctive factor, which makes country houses different, for example, from the grand townhouses the same families owned in cities like London. But the estate was to some extent a self-sufficient bubble before that, because it was it had to have water supply from somewhere, and it might have been it could have just been from a stream, river, or a lake, or wells, or whatever. And they were self-sufficient very often in terms of their food supplies from their own farms and so on. So they were, through before the industrial period, really self-sufficient, but obviously if they wanted the fruits of industrialization, the comforts that technology could bring, they still had to be self-sufficient. So when gas lighting came along, they had to build their own gas works, and when they realized that the water from the local rivers was no longer healthy to drink, they had to put in their own sort of improved water supplies, and they had to get rid of their sewage and as you say, electric lighting and so on later. So yes, it is an important distinction, and often these sort of relics of their self-sufficiency are some of the most important early examples of this technology, because in other situations it is gone. But on the country house estates, a lot of the archaeological evidence is still there, because they didn't really get rid of much, a lot of them.
I wonder if, before we get into some of the examples of this innovation, you could speak a bit about this relationship between the industrial archaeology and the evidence that it provides for us. And basically, how do we use archaeology to understand this stuff today? I mean, how do we use it to understand how can we use that to access this aspect of history?
Okay. Well, I think you're right to emphasize the archaeological nature of our work, and that is one aspect in which it is perhaps unique. People have written either not in such depth as we have, but briefly about the introduction of technology and these sort of new comforts and so on, but from a historical perspective. Now, one of the key aspects for us is to look for the physical remains, because the physical remains tell you what actually happened, and we can look in the archives of houses and their account books and so on, and find correspondence about all sorts of wonderful things that people were trying to sell to the owners of country houses, and people often make the mistake of assuming, because you've got estimates and specifications and things, all this stuff that actually got built. Whereas our approach is to start with look at what the physical evidence is in terms of either in the house. We're looking at the pipes and the wires and things like that, and but also in the estate as well, to understand, well, what did they actually do to match the, and then you can go and look at the historical evidence and tie that up to the physical remains. So being archaeologists, it gave us a different approach to that which other people had used, and means that we do actually then, you know, we avoid mistakes of either looking at historical information which is misleading because it relates to things that were proposed and never actually completed, or sometimes you look at physical objects in a house and they've been brought in either you know, by their original owners, or often by in the early days of the heritage bodies who owns most of these houses, they wanted to restore houses, and so they put things in sometimes which were not actually original to the house and incongruous. So we have to have a sort of not just look at the object, but look at the object in its context to understand, to make sure that it does actually belong where it is. So that's, if you like, that's what the archaeological approach brings. We start off with the physical artifacts, be they just simple little light fittings or bells or whatever, and then sort of extrapolate that out to the whole system. So and that's the same approach we would take with any sort of building, really, you know, industrial site, for example. We would start with the physical remains and then try and use the historical information to interpret the physical remains rather than starting with the historical information. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. And of course the single largest piece of technology that you address in the book is the physical structure of the house itself. And I had never really thought of it about that way, but as you explain in this book and as you illustrate, and I have to say that this is a book that is very generously illustrated with numerous pictures of demonstrating some of the things you're talking about, is that the buildings themselves were often designed or grafted with innovations, such as with heating. You described, yes, some of the early designs when it comes to heating a house that, yes, involve, and I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate upon some of the ways in which these houses were built or rebuilt to provide better heating than just the open hearth fireplace.
Yes. Okay. I mean, that perhaps one point to say at the outset is that most of these systems were not particularly effective, and there was still a reliance on the open fireplace right through until the middle of the 20th century, really. But nevertheless, people worked very hard and invested a lot of money to try and keep these vast houses a little less chilly than they otherwise would have been. It didn't really end of the 18th century is when we start seeing sort of technology coming into play and what we would regard as a centralized heating systems. And that was technology which was brought in from textile mills. So hence you know, another reason why those of us who sort of main archaeological interests are things like factories and so on. This is natural territory for us because a lot of the technologies came from that direction. And so warm air heating systems which were pioneered for textile mills started to be used in country houses, but they were very difficult to retrofit into an existing house, especially an old house, you know, a medieval house, because you need large ducts under the floors and in the walls and things to convey the warm air, and especially you are relying on convection to carry the warm air around. You've got no fans or anything, so you know, these ducts need to be large with a furnace or boiler or something in the basement, in the cellars of the house, and the warm air rising through these ducts into the house. So it was difficult to fit into existing houses, but an awful lot of houses were built from scratch throughout, particularly the first half of the 19th century. There was a big period of house building, and so you could incorporate these sorts of innovations from the outset. So heating was easy to do in that respect, and that was the systems that were used in country houses throughout the 19th century were mainly some form of conveying heated air taken from the outside, heated, and then ducted around the house into the rooms. People didn't, the idea that you heated the room, the air that was already in the room by means of what we would call radiators, was very strongly condemned by the medical profession. It was deemed to be very unhygienic. So the sorts of systems that we use today with water heated radiators in the rooms were really not considered appropriate until the end of the 19th century. But certainly warm air systems were very important for the houses that were built in that period.
It's not just the houses, though. As you describe in one of your early chapters, you also have the creation of these greenhouses and garden walls. And this gets to this interesting contiguous development, which is the expansion of empire during the 18th century. You start to see these country houses wanting these exotic plants, especially fruit-bearing plants, and this is where you get orangeries and greenhouses. And there, because they don't have to redesign or build a brand new country house, they are building these adjunct structures and incorporating the designs there. And I thought it was fascinating. These structures I've seen before, like your the furnace that they built into the heating walls, and you describe how that is sort of an early technology and why it was unsuccessful. But there you're seeing an example of how maybe they couldn't build into the house itself, but they were definitely incorporating this technology to improve their lives and in a way increase their status.
Yes, status is very much the driving force here, impressing your dinner guests, impressing your visitors. So you've got two aspects to that. You've got the ornamental aspects of the gardens and the sort of develops in water supply with pumps, for example, were often used first to provide water to the gardens before they were deemed appropriate to be used for providing water to the houses. So quite a few of the systems and the technology for water supply was first adopted to provide water for fountains and water features and so on. So that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect, as you say, is the growing of exotic fruits. The pineapple was the sort of the crowning glory of a table and a grand dinner. Pineapples were deemed to be so exotic and very strong symbolism. You'll see the pineapple as a architectural symbol on buildings, on gate pillars and on buildings and so on. It had a lot of symbolism attached to it. But so if you could grow your own pineapples, you know, that was because apart from anything else, it was hugely labor intensive. A bit like, you know, having a brightly lit dining room was very expensive and labor intensive because you need a lot of people to tend the candles and the lamps and so on. Having these fruit grown in your own houses was a demonstration you could afford to employ an awful lot of gardeners to sort of round the clock almost look after these delicate plants. And the way that the pineapples were grown in pits with manure mixed into the soil to warm the soil it just took a huge amount of effort. So they were great demonstrations of wealth and sophistication.
And they were also great demonstrations of technology, because even with the resources they possessed, as you described, the technology really is essential to making it viable, even with the labor that they have available to them in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Yes. What you're getting from the late 18th century is things like increased use of iron for structures for greenhouses and orangeries and so on, and the ability to make glass in larger panes, so that these things all come together, all part of the industrialization, if you like, from the end of the 18th century. Iron and glass, so you can build these wonderful glass houses, and then you have heating systems which enable you to heat them, and so they all come together, and they're all driven, if you like, that these technologies were driven by people wanting to spend large amounts of money to grow these plants to impress their guests.
One aspect of industrialization that does get a lot of attention, of course, is pollution. And as you've already alluded to, one of the challenges they were facing during this period was the growing problem of polluted water supply. It's not a new one. It goes all the way back to humans using rivers as disposal points for all sorts of offal and so forth. But yeah, that problem seems to be growing. And you described the ways in which they were innovating with, you know, in terms of going up further upstream to draw water supplies, drawing wells, and how this required a large investment in infrastructure to make it all work.
Yes, I mean, but yes, to getting clean water. This was a 19th century phenomenon, as greater realization that the health problems associated with contaminated water, which was very much from the mid 19th century onwards. People then began to devote more attention to sourcing cleaner water from springs and boreholes and so on. It took a long time before they actually started to do anything about the sewage. The sewage they just dumped downstream, somebody else's problem. So it really wasn't until the end of the 19th century you got any science and investment devoted to safely disposing of the waste. But certainly throughout the 19th century, people became increasingly focused on the health of the cleanliness of their water.
When I read about the introduction of septic systems, I was thinking about how similar that is today to so many people that live in remote areas and very much rely upon those systems as their primary means of waste disposal. And it's just so funny to read about it as this innovatory technology that they were very tentatively applying to. And yet, you know, it's an example of how it was a pioneering of what has now become commonplace in such circumstances.
Yes, yes. I mean that technology is essentially still in use, both on a sort of individual basis for remote properties and indeed for a lot of municipal or public sewage systems. And a lot of the certainly until relatively recently, that technology had not been superseded.
You describe the water supply, but of course, it's not really the most dramatic innovation when it comes to water, because it's also what you also see during this period is the growing effort to supply water to the houses themselves. And this is something that recurs throughout your book, because it deals with both the infrastructure of building, introducing plumbing, and also the ancillary parts of heating it. And you have many pictures of the baths, the showers that they were building. And I was wondering if you could speak to some of the challenges they faced there in terms of plumbing. I mean, something that goes back to the Romans, yet, at the very least, is something you would think that would be already in place. And yet you describe that this was really an age at which indoor plumbing becomes so much more commonplace in these houses.
Yeah, it was quite slow to be adopted. I mean, there are a few examples. A few houses were having piped water supplies in the 18th century, cold water, that is. But it was probably still not common until the second half of the 19th century. In the upper floors of the house, anyway, you might have piped water in the kitchens and laundries and things like that. But water supplies in the bedrooms and so on and for bathing were being brought up. Especially if you wanted hot water, because there was no means of heating the water. So this was really the towards the end of the 19th century before piped hot and cold water supplies, and therefore baths and showers and things like that, became really widely used. And even then, it was a lot of houses didn't really have it until the end of the 19th century. So the technology was, in theory, it was available. In practice, it was not very reliable, and so it was quite slow to be adopted.
One of my favorite pictures in the book is a relatively mundane one. It's the first picture you have in chapter 3, which is of a wooden water pipe. And I can understand why you don't see these too often, because obviously these types of pipes really are unlikely to endure for centuries. And it really, that picture in itself does demonstrate a lot of the challenges of simply supplying these houses.
Yes, I had to fight to get that. I had to fight to get that picture in the book, actually, because other people thought it was a little boring, really. But I agree with you. It is important. It's a potent symbol, really. And the wooden, there's an awful, probably still an awful lot of wooden pipes in the ground somewhere, because they survived quite well in some conditions. But and yes, until the really end of the 18th, early 19th century, the technology wasn't there for making cast iron pipes, it was uneconomic to use lead for long distances. Lead piping was used internally in the houses, but sometimes copper or but often lead, but you couldn't use that for long distances. So you either had open channels, which is, you know, or sometimes you might have clay pipes, but mostly wood, and so that was again another it was a break on these sorts of infrastructure until the technology was around to make iron pipes for in large quantities.
Did the condition of these early pipes inhibit some of the technologies? Because I'm wondering about this dynamic of technology integration. How, for example, you have these early pipes of wood and lead that are designed maybe for a certain flow of water, and how as you start to see steam pumps and so forth being introduced, the degree to which the piping simply is not designed to handle water that could be introduced at a more rapid flow, and whether or not that creates problems.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's certainly there's a great limit on the capacity of these systems, so that water, you know, piped water is therefore, you know, a precious commodity, if you think about the fact that in a lot of cases it was being used in the gardens, you were perhaps only doing that when you didn't turn it on until the visitors came, so to impress them you didn't have it running all the time, so yes, that there's definitely a constraint on the capacity of these systems, because you know the limit, the size that you could make wooden pipes and the economics of all of that, really, until. Until we get into the early 1800s, the early 19th century.
This gets to one of the important aspects of technological introduction and innovation, which is how it changes the way lives are lived in the house. And you describe this in the third chapter when you talk about how you start to see the expansion of bathrooms and how this makes possible all sorts of new innovations. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that relationship when it came to showers and baths and so forth, in terms of, you know, how this technology enables those changes to proceed.
Yeah, one thing you have to bear in mind is there's a certain amount of inertia amongst the house owning class, if you like, and their guests, which meant that very often they even when it was perfectly feasible to have plumbed in bathrooms and showers and so on, they preferred to still have a what we would call a hip bath filled by hand, sitting, you know, bathing in front of the fire in their dressing rooms. Part of it was perhaps, you know, a reluctance to leave the warmth of their dressing room to go down next door to a less warm bathroom. But I think there's a sort of almost a prejudice here, a sort of snobbery, really, fixed bathrooms, like ensuite bathrooms, if you like, was a bit of a bourgeois thing, and the gentlemen didn't do that. They bathed in front of the fire. So there's a little bit of a sort of social stigma. Interestingly, one of the first people to install a fixed shower in attached to their bathroom was Queen Victoria, or Victoria and Albert, at Osborne, and they did lots in a way to sort of break down some of these prejudices. The same happened with lifts, passenger lifts. People felt the same about passenger lifts. The gentleman used the stairs. Lifts were things you got in hotels. You didn't have them in your house. And the same with bathrooms. So there's obviously a technical constraint that meant that you couldn't really have piped hot water until sort of the second half of 19th century, because the systems were not very reliable. But also there were cultural prejudices against these things until relatively late. So you get, and the same to some extent with flushing toilets. You might get bathrooms, and some houses have bathrooms and flushing toilets for their servants before they were put in the areas for the families and their guests, because the families and their guests had servants who would empty the baths and empty the chamber pots and so on. There is not just technological constraints, but also cultural ones.
Another area where you see this slow replacement of technology that you describe in some detail is when it comes to food preparation. And you describe in that chapter about how this is one of the most heavily written about aspects of a country house. And you go into details to how food preparation was changed by all this technology. I was wondering if you can go into some detail about that, maybe in terms of how food originally was prepared and the technologies that were changing that.
Yes. Right, almost from prehistory until fairly recently, it was considered the only way to cook meat, for example, was in front of an open fire, just by roasting with radiant heat, and that was really not that idea held sway really until beginning of the 20th century, and so people were reluctant to put in large ovens, for example, for cooking things like meat, because that was not deemed not to be a very satisfactory way to cook, and pans were heated either on open fires or on charcoal stoves, which is obviously a very messy process and limited in terms of scale. So again, it's a question of to what extent these innovations are driven by the need or by the available technology, and it's definitely a combination of two. As life in the country has become more sophisticated and more devoted to impressing your guests with house parties and so on, therefore you were getting more elaborate meals, and therefore you needed a range of types of cooking. So you had to have pastry ovens for all the delicate pastries, and then you got the innovative sort of lots of different vegetables and fish and so on all being cooked on what the kitchen range, as we would recognize it now, which is solid coal fired range, which was a development really from the early 19th century, again as manufacturing technologies and use of cast iron became more sophisticated. You could make more sophisticated cooking appliances, kitchen ranges for heating things, but still the centerpiece of the meals, the big pieces of meat and game and so on, would have been cooked in front of open fire.
And that's also why you go to so many of these houses today, as you point out in the book, and you'll see this juxtaposition of technologies, which is not an error or a misunderstanding, but reflected the fact that in, say, 1880, you would still have the open fire, the open range, yes, and the closed range, yes, all sitting in the same room.
Absolutely, yes. People would not have contemplated doing without the open roasting range really through until the early part of the 20th century, really, as tastes changed, and to some extent, cooking appliances probably got better. The control was their temperature control was better, so things perhaps tasted better.
Another aspect of food preparation technology that you describe is refrigeration. And you go into the way they used to refrigerate things, and what was interesting is, as you describe, the technology of, shall we say, artificial refrigeration really improves in the middle of the 19th century. And yet you quote, and I love this quote, this one manual or article in which they were saying, as late as around 1900, well, this refrigeration thing is a bit of a fad. No, you know, country house really need adopt it.
Yes. Well, again, people relied on old labor intensive technology, which was, you collect the ice every winter and you fill the ice house, and then you can use the ice to keep to use in chilling cabinets, basically, to keep things cold. And of course, I mean, that they were because these states were self-sufficient, they were eating their own meat. They were often eating the fish that been caught in their own lakes and rivers and so on. So the needs for preserving food for long period, fresh food in that way for long periods is not as we would see it today. But even so, the processes they were using were relatively date back to Rome times or whatever, with just harvesting and storing ice and using it when you needed it. Few country houses adopted refrigeration, and that was not at all common. Even when electricity became available, electrically powered refrigerators were still not common, and probably until the 1920s, 1930s.
And that gets to an aspect of this dynamic of technological transition that you point to occasionally in the book, which is that a lot of these older technologies were perfectly usable. They already had them set up. So why would they go through the expense of adopting new ones, especially when they are facing expenditures in terms of other technologies elsewhere? You see this, for example, with lighting in your book,
yes, right?
How you describe how quickly they go from candles to gas to electricity, and how each transition requires sometimes a very considerable expenditure.
Indeed, I mean that in that case they were achieving results that couldn't have been achieved by the old means, if you like, to some extent. Certainly, once the crucial invention for lighting, in a sense, was the argand oil lamp, which is often forgotten, and that for people who could afford lamp oil, that was quite a successful technology, and the gas lighting, in a lot of circumstances came along afterwards, was no better, but it was a lot cheaper. So it was more convenient but people still continued to use oil lighting and candles in their grander rooms because of the problems with burning gas gives off noxious fumes, which you don't get so much with candles and oil lamps.
You also quote contemporaries talking about how they simply preferred the lighting of oil lamps in terms of how people appear in it, as opposed to the harsher light. And I was thinking about how sometimes people complain about fluorescence today for the same reason.
Yes, it's interesting, particularly as actually the early gas lighting was not that harsh. It's certainly true with early electric lighting, until people learned to use it more creatively and to use it more decoratively and to make lighting more subdued and less intrusive. But yes, there was certainly a factor dinner party was and even to this day, to some extent, best lit with candles, because it increased the sort of ambience and the spectacle of the occasion as much as anything, rather than having all this bright light. But to some extent, the technology, both with gas lighting and electricity, enabled levels of lighting to be achieved. Much greater levels of lighting to be achieved, and so were, for practical purposes, particularly in service areas and actually outdoors, and the estate was an important factor.
And yet, you have these pictures of both contemporary and modern day pictures of the machinery involved. They would have to, as you were saying earlier, build their own gasworks, install their own generators, and how sometimes they were being called up in some houses that had been what we nowadays would refer to as early adopters, brought in gas at an early point. Within a generation, they're now have this alternative,
yes.
And to be fair, perhaps this is unfair, but more faddish yes. you know, idea of electricity. So they have to basically take out the gasworks, put in the electricity.
Yes, absolutely. And that, yes, that was within the space of 20 years in some cases. So you had to disturb the fabric of your house to put pipes in for the gas lighting. You then do it again for putting in the wiring for the electric lighting. So, but electric lighting was very much a fashion. And again, it was because of the cost of the plant and the people to run it and the fittings. It was another demonstration of your wealth and sophistication if you could have electric lighting. Some people actually just installed electric lighting temporarily for a special occasion. If they're having a grand ball, they would light bits of the house and the gardens temporarily, and then it would all get taken away again.
Is there any archaeological remnant of it? Like, do they install the machine in a particular location and just simply dismantle it and reinstall it when they had another party, or do they simply have a plant in place and just leave it disused for the long periods of time where they didn't want it?
Now, these early, we're talking about a brief period, really, before people decided that actually electric lighting was something that they needed on a permanent basis, at which point they invested in their own plant. But for a brief period around 1880, you had companies who would come along with a generator plant on wheels, basically, and wire it all up and then take it all down again and drive away.
Are there any examples of that available today in museums? Because I must confess, I've never heard about this technology until now.
No, not really. No, obviously, because the idea was it came and it went. So it's a facet which isn't really surviving. But of course, the same sorts of systems were used for things like fairgrounds. The types of equipment that they were using survived on and probably still preserved with fairground engines and things like that. But you had a steam powered vehicle with a dynamo on it that would generate electricity to light a few rooms. So it's that sort of technology, so it still survives, but in another context.
Another aspect of technology that we indelibly associate with the 19th century are railways. And one of the interesting parts of the book to me was the number of estates that had some form of rail transportation put in over the course of the 19th century. And a lot of this, as you describe, has more to do with estate operation. But still, it's fascinating to think about how many of these estates had, in essence, their own railway services available to them.
Yes, I mean, you should emphasize these are man hauled, with one or two exceptions. That's the sort of rail technology that was used in coal mines, for example, at the time. You just had little narrow railways with trucks which were pushed by people, or sometimes hauled by animals. And sometimes these were underground because, especially if they were in the gardens, the idea was that you moved goods around, coal particularly, but other things as well, invisibly, because you didn't particularly want your guests to be seeing the coal being delivered to the boilers. So you put a little tunnel in and you brought the coal in on little railway trucks.
I was thinking they probably were very insistent that, this is not a Royal Navy ship. They don't want to see people, shoveling coal into the furnaces.
No, that's right. The idea is it's all hidden away, moving the goods happens invisibly. The food arrives, you hope still warm, invisibly from the kitchens, and so on. So yes, it's about demonstration of sophistication of your household.
You raise another interesting point that you address at the end of the book, which is this idea of technology transfer. Because what we're seeing is during this industrial era, as this technology is developing, the ways in which it's being adapted. I was wondering if you could speak more to this, the degree to which was it entirely a one-way process, for example, or were sometimes people adopting innovations and so impressed by them, they were introducing them into their businesses or investing in them more because of the proof of concept, if you will?
Yeah. The sort of tracing the transfer of technology from region to region, from person to person, or from one context, industrial context, to a domestic one, is quite difficult. There's very little source material to guide us in this respect. One thing you do find in the 19th century is the growth of printed sources of journals of sort of on technological subjects, right from perhaps from the end of the 18th century onwards. So you do get sharing of information through the print media, if you like, increasingly through the 19th century, Some of the pioneers of domestic technology were prominent industrialists, and you can see that they're using technology that they would have been familiar with in their factories. The house that had the first passenger lift, or any type of lift, certainly in Britain, no longer standing, was built by owner of an iron company. And he was making, obviously they were making sort of pipe work and probably almost certainly using hydraulic equipment in their works. So you know, it was a natural extension for him to say, I want it in my house. So there are examples like that, but that's not necessarily the whole picture, and it's not even necessarily a typical picture. But if you then somebody has then got that technology, other people will, you know, that their neighbors who might not be from an industrial background will visit, and they will say, oh right, okay, so who do I talk to about this? But it is very difficult sometimes to trace the evolution of technology. Towards the end of the 19th century, with electricity, you can do it. We with lots of correspondence between some of these aristocratic people like Lord Salisbury, who was prime minister twice in Victorian times, and he was quite an enthusiast for electric lighting. So he corresponded directly with Joseph Swan, who was the man who made the first working electric light bulb. It wasn't just for your American listeners. It wasn't Thomas Edison. It was Joseph Swan. But anyway, Joseph Swan just got the patent first. He got the patent before he actually made a successful example. But you know, I think that was perhaps the smart way around of doing it. But you can see the correspondence between people and the Duke of Marlborough at Blenheim corresponded with Edison in America about their, you know, details of electric lighting systems. So these people who are, you know, from long established aristocratic families in some cases were very much interested in technology of the age, and they would, you know, they were meeting with and writing to the technocrats to get advice as to how to proceed.
And as you describe, there's another aspect of this as well, which is the degree to which these early adopters, these aristocrats who are willing to do this, become advertisements for the manufacturers. So they can, as you describe, they'll point to, well, Lord some such and Lord thus and so has this, and
yes,
so you should put it in your home as well.
Yes, one of the fascinating things is to look at the brochures and the catalogs produced by some of the companies selling for lighting equipment or water pumping equipment and other things, agricultural machinery. Their brochures always include at the back a list of their customers. And one of the fascinating things about this is it's very sort of hierarchical. You start off with, you know, royalty and the dukes and so on, and then you work your way down the sort of the peerage to the people who are, you know, just MPs and right honourables and things, and then laymen. You know, they're very hierarchical. You start off with the people at the top of the society. First of all, that was very much a 19th century advertising ploy. You would want to shout about all the important people who'd bought your products.
It just strikes me as so familiar to us today. Whereas nowadays it's, you know, your pop celebrities. Back then it was your aristocrats, but it was, you know, that form of advertising does seem to be sort of interwoven into our society, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. They were the people who were in the papers. Yes, not that we didn't have any rivals in those days.
Certainly not rivals who could afford to, you know, that level of investment.
No, only then, as in the 19th century, you do get the wealthy industrialists who, very often, the children, the grandchildren of the wealthy industrialists, sometimes who want to become country gentlemen and will take on the mantle of the country gentleman and will take on that role because they've taken on the estate and therefore they are their local the local landowner.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
The technology that the Country House Technology Project is still sort of alive. The book was a distillation of about 4 years of fairly active research going around to about 100 houses and doing a lot of research in other sources, but. So the book has distilled that, but we are still working with various either heritage bodies and house owners to help them interpret and understand the remains that they've got. So you know, we're using the knowledge that we've gained to help with the restoration of features within houses and their interpretation. So that's one aspect of it. We're still doing a lot of outreach work with going around and lecturing to people and running tours around houses and so on. So the country house work is still very active, albeit on a lower level than it was while we were doing the research for the book and then writing it. my project, I've just another finished is looking at mechanics institutes, which is a type of building that grew up in the 19th century for the education of working people before state funded adult education was available, and they exist in America as well, of course. Mechanics institutes very much a product of the sort of, again, the industrialization. So that's a little project I've just been working on, Marilyn is probably more involved still with country house technology than I am, because she does a lot of lecturing to special interest groups and she's running more tours than I am at the moment. So her, although she's involved with many other aspects of archaeology as well, I would say, you know, the country house technology is probably still her main focus in her retirement, and to a less extent for me. I'm still doing a bit.
Well, it's a topic that seems like the depths of which are only just now being plumbed. I look forward to seeing more work on it.
Oh, thank you. I mean, what we'd really like is somebody to cough up some money so that we could come and look at some American examples. And when in my occasional holidays in America, I go to places like Jefferson's House, Monticello, and look, because he was an important figure, of course. Thomas Jefferson, and influenced the design of fireplaces that came over here and other things, there's a lovely piece, lots of work we could do if somebody would come and pay us to come over to America for a bit. That would be good.
Well, best of luck with that. Ian West, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule today to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much. It was great. I enjoyed it.